Well, thank you for being here this morning. Half the day's already gone by, isn't it? I'm one of those irritating morning people. I can get up at 4:30, I am ready to go. I don't need any artificial stimulants like coffee, I'm just ready. So this morning we're going to do a little apologizing. That's what apologetics means, doesn't it? What does it mean then? It means we know what we believe, why we believe it, and we can communicate that to other people. That's what apologetics means. Short version, we can defend what we believe. It's Greek apologia. So you learn language. So we're going to answer six challenges. Now I want to make this, since this is Sunday school, we can make this interactive. You can ask questions as we go through here. And I'll let you know, there are dumb questions. I don't know about teachers say there's no such thing as a dumb question. That's a lie. There are really dumb questions. But any question will be a fair question here. It deals about creation, the Bible, evolution. Those are fair questions. The only question I'm not going to allow you to ask is this. Mike, I have a dumb question. Why can't you ask that? Because how do you think I'm going to feel if I can't answer it? They'll be good questions. Okay. So six challenges. Number one, who did Cain marry? I've seen this on the History Channel twice now. And they taught the Bible was an embarrassment. Millions of people watch that on TV. Bring all these scholars talking about how embarrassing the Bible is. Well, we got Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve. So who did Cain marry? Well, that's easy. Some hairy ape woman. No, that's not true. Well, the first answer is, let's go to the Bible. Genesis chapter 5, verse 4 gives us a good part of the answer. And it says there, of Adam and Eve, they had other sons and daughters, plural. Oh, Mike, are you telling me that Cain married his sister? You can't do that. That's against the law. That's called incest. So are you saying the Bible is teaching incest is good? That's what you just told me. But it's right there in the Bible. Well, what is incest? It's marrying your close relation. Why don't they allow you to marry your brother or sister? One reason is you probably don't like them that much, but I'll let you cover that one faster another time. But the other reason is mutations. We all have mutations in us. If the husband and wife both have the same mutation, there's a good possibility that children could be harmed or deformed. So we don't want you marrying your close relation to protect the children. But what is the Bible saying here? Marry your sister, marry your close relation. Are they violating whose law? Well, wait a minute now. That's our law we have now. But if we go back to the beginning, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And how good was God's creation? Very good. It was very good. Perfect. Meaning there were no mutations. Everything was going fine. Then comes the fall, the curse. All of creation is under the curse. And now mutations start coming in to the species. But it wasn't till the book of Leviticus, chapter 25, that God outlawed marrying your close relation. See, for all that time, up to Leviticus chapter 18, it was okay to marry your close relation, your brother or sister. Why? Because we did not have the genetic load of mutations in us. So it was not incest. See, the History Channel either doesn't like Christianity or they don't do their homework. That should give you a lack of trust in that. Then God intervenes and says, after 2,500 years of accumulating mutations, don't do it anymore. God laid the law down. We didn't invent it. God did. So it was perfectly fine to marry your close relation up until then. Who did Abraham marry? His half-sister. Was that okay? Yes, because that's still back in the book of Genesis, isn't it? So it was okay to do that. So who did Cain marry? Most likely his sister, a very close relation. Was that against the law? No, because we did not have the genetic load of mutations in us then. I'm now going to hold you accountable for knowing this information. I'm going to be in this area for about 9 days. The next time I see you, I'm going to ask you this question. If I see you driving in a car down the street, I'm going to stop you and ask you this question. And if you cannot answer who did Cain marry, you will be doing push-ups. That is my cure for everything. I have a great way to teach. I think it is the greatest way. How many teachers do I have here? Anybody teach? I think it is the most effective way to teach. It's called fear and intimidation. How many wish you hadn't come to Sunday school now? Worked well. Okay, so we know how to answer that one now. Let's do challenge two. 2 Peter 3:8 teaches the days of creation were long periods of time. Well, first of all, let's look at 2 Peter 3:8. It reads this way. But beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. Right there, does it not teach that the days of creation could be long periods of time? I see a doubter there. It sure says the day could be 1,000 years and even more. Well, what are we going to do about that? Well, let's answer this one. Two questions I have. Number one, what does the word day mean in this verse? And secondly, can what's in this verse be applied to Genesis chapter 1? People are quite oftenly taking the Bible out of context. And we will not do that today. Well, answering the challenge, one day is 1,000 years. We're going to go through this systematically. And this is why I want to train you how to do this. We're not there to beat people up. We're there to be witnesses, evangelists. So a great way to answer questions like this is sometimes teach the answer so they remember it better. So we're going to go through three steps. Number one, context matters. We'll look at the context of 2 Peter 3:8. Then we'll look at the style of writing. Then we're going to come to a conclusion. It's almost like logic. Premise, premise, conclusion, isn't it? How many like logic? Okay, I got a pretty good hand show, but let me rephrase this. Logic is a characteristic of God. How many like logic? Okay, good, good. I could just about sell anything. That's an easy sell, Bible. Okay, context. When you read the full context, 2 Peter 3:8, we read above it and below, what we find out is it's not talking about the beginning. It's talking about the end times. Talking about the characteristics of God. God created time. God's the creator of everything. He's not bound by time. He stands outside of time. So, number one, it's not referencing the creation account. It's referencing the end times. Number two, style of writing. There's a key word in this verse. Anybody see it? And you were thinking as, weren't you? That's what you say. Say as. Exactly right. So I can see the sine waves coming from our head there. Everybody took trigonometry? Oh, you would love it. Just get these great big long equations and they all fall out to something real small and simple. How many can't wait to take trigonometry now? The word as here. No, I really didn't see the sine waves coming. I can't see those. As. See, as is what we call a simile, or in this case, a figure of speech. Which means this verse is not meant to be taken literally. Now, what is a figure of speech? It's where you paint a picture to have somebody understand what you're saying. For example,
I can use you as an example. Okay?
I saw her running the other day, and she runs like a gazelle. Did I just call her an animal? No, I didn't. I used a figure of speech. A gazelle. They run gracefully, and they run fast. And that's true, isn't it?
I do not run well.
Okay. Well, figure speech anyway. All right, let's do another. Yesterday it was raining like cats and dogs. Light is another one of those words. Were cats and dogs literally coming down? No. It's a figure speech painting a picture of a torrential downpour. And that's what this verse is about. It's saying this. God created time. He's now bound by time. So 1,000 years is like a day to him. But we are bound by time. So this is a figure of speech not meant to be taken literally. So look at the context. It's not talking about the beginning. It's talking about the end times. The attributes of God. The style of writing is not narrative, Hebrew narrative or Greek. It is a figure of speech. Therefore, we can draw a conclusion. 2 Peter 3:8 cannot be used to support the days of grace or long periods of time, or we are taking God's word out of context, and we should not do that. So we've answered that challenge. Okay, which side wants to answer the? I have a question. Which side would like to answer this question? Boy, I got a fear everywhere. Okay, somebody got smart and volunteered this side. Somebody over there volunteered. Don't miss this one because you know there's a penalty already. Who did Cain marry? The sister. That's incest, isn't it?
No.
Why not?
No.
And what was significant about that? Mutations, genetic mutations. Right. Very good. So it was not incest. It was perfectly fine to do because we did not have the genetic load of mutations. Good, good. This side will get another one. I just love to pick on people. That's why it's so fun to teach. Okay, here's a big one. How in the world could Noah fit all those millions of creatures on the ark? Now, did I add something there that's not in the Bible? Millions, yes. Non-believers tend to put that millions in there. It's not what the Bible teaches. In other words, when I teach critical thinking, one of the things I teach is listen carefully to their words. And you're going to find out you don't have to answer a lot of questions. Because you find out their challenge is not even a logical challenge, or it's an incorrect challenge. And you also find out they have a bigger problem with what they're talking about than we do. I take all my lessons from how did Jesus teach. That's where I get my lessons. So how could Noah fit all the animals in the ark? Answering the challenge. We're going to go through three parts again. Kind of like pastors do, don't they? That means we're going to be rushing through the last part. Sorry. How did the animals get to the ark? How big was the ark? And how many animals and creatures really needed to be on the ark? So we'll examine it that way. So how did the animals get to the ark? That's very easy. It's right there in Genesis chapter 6, verse 20. Of the birds after the kind, of animals after the kind, and every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you. That answers the question, doesn't it? God supernaturally brings the creatures to the ark. Noah does not have to go out on some wild safari and round them all up. Okay. Now, how big was the ark? First one, what did we believe the ark looked like? Which one there? The bottom one. Now, we don't know exactly, but that's our best guess based on the information we have in the Bible. The other two are typically what we find in Christian bookstores, television, and children's church. Now, if you have one of these, sometimes, and you don't have it in your children's church, you need to show it to your children. Why? Because it can be a wonderful teaching tool. What you do is you show them this, because they're going to see these pictures everywhere. Houseboats with giraffe heads sticking out, bathtubs and creatures on it. Show them these pictures. And then say, let's go to the Bible and read what the Bible has to say. And it gives the dimensions of it, and you can kind of draw on the board. Like, just draw a big rectangle, and you can tell them it's about 1.5 football fields long. Or you can take them outside if you have the time and mark that off, about 1.5 football fields. Then they'll get the idea and say, oh, those pictures are not what the Bible teaches. It's a great tool for learning there. So if you have those pictures, make sure they see them, because they're going to see them, and they're going to be confused unless they're taught. So first two there are not what the Bible teaches. Well, let's look at this. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Does that mean anything to anybody? How many here talk in terms of cubits? I watched somebody, one of you jump the other day, and you jumped 5 and a half cubits. That wouldn't be very far. Some people almost stand and long jump that far. Okay, let's get an idea. That's about 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Now, let's take a look at some other ways to describe it. 1.5 football fields long. That's a pretty good description to tell people to get an idea. Length-width ratio, 6:1. What's significant about that? The perfect dimensions for floating. Wow, how did Noah know to do that? Isn't that amazing? We build some of our modern barges on those. First of all, was the ark designed to go anywhere? No, because there was nowhere to go. Everything was covered with water. All it had to do was stay afloat. Now this one means something to everybody, doesn't it? Volume about 1.5 million cubic feet. Doesn't mean anything to me either, so don't worry. How about this? About 100,000 square feet of floor space. Now you say, well, our house is this many square feet. How many houses could fit on there? Or equivalent to about 520 railroad boxcars. That's the one I'm going to use here. Let's take a look at this. What is included? Part 3. Living things with the breath of life. Genesis chapter 7 says everything with the breath of life went on there. Beast and cattle, 2- and 4-footed animals. That includes us too, doesn't it? Birds. Creeping things, like small reptiles we're talking about there. Sea creatures were not included. Why? Because a flood would not put them into a state of extinction. Because where did they live? In the oceans. Many would have perished during the flood because it's a violent flood. But they would have survived. Many would have also survived. So let's go on that premise there. Only 2 of each kind went on the ark. 2 of each of the dog kind or canine kind. 2 of the pachyderm kind. 2 of the cat kind. Not 4, 5, or 50 of each. Only 2 of each kind. 7 of some. We consume a maximum of about 20,000 kinds. That's being very generous, folks. We believe that the kinds would have been a lot less than that. So that'd be 40,000 creatures. I'm being very generous there. About 40,000. The average size animal is about the size of a small sheep. That went on that ark. Why? Does it ever say God brought the grandma and grandpa creatures to the ark? Doesn't say that. All God had to bring were what? The young creatures. And the average size would have been the size of a small sheep or smaller. Well, we'll use the sheep here. The average double-deck stock car railroad can actually accommodate over 200 sheep. I'm just going to go 200 to make easy round. How many like easy round numbers? Yes. So 200 sheep per boxcar. A train pulling 200 cars could carry 40,000 sheep. Isn't that the number we need to put on there? Just 200 cars. So there's where you get that. 200 cars times 200 sheep, 40,000, for those of you who like math there. So we got 200 cars full. We got 320 cars still available for Noah, family, luggage, and food. This is pretty easy now, isn't it? Plenty of room to put all that on there. Well, let's make this harder. What about the dinosaurs? They had the breath of life in them, didn't they? Oh, Mike, they died out millions of years ago. No, they didn't. We're going to cover that in one of the talks this week. What about dinosaurs? Well, did the big giant dinosaurs have to go in there? Were you this big when you were born? No, and your mothers are grateful, aren't they? You know the dinosaurs, the largest dinosaur egg we found is only about the size of a football, barely the size of a football. That means these great big dinosaurs had to start small too, didn't they? Just bring the young dinosaurs on board. There are about 100 known species. I know some of the evolution books teach about 400, 200, and they're all over the place with it. What we're finding out is we've made a lot of mistakes in identifying these bones. It comes down to about 100. So that would give us 200 dinosaurs, male and female. So we've got to add 200 creatures on the ark. Well, if we put 50 per boxcar, that's giving us plenty of room for these creatures. That's only 4 boxcars. So now we have 240 cars full and 316 empty. We're still doing pretty good, aren't we? What about insects now? Well, that's a touchy one. Because insects don't have the breath of life like we have. They don't breathe like we do with lungs. They have the pores in their shells. They also don't have blood like us. But you know, there's some of those insects that are very delicate and may not be able to survive a flood, like butterflies and bees and things like that. So let's put them on. How about that? Can we just put them on? So they don't have nostrils like we do. They don't have blood like we do. And there's some delicate ones. So let's take that into account. Would it be possible to have 1 million insects on that ark? Oh, well, Insects are pretty small, aren't they? And that would also have to include the cockroach, too. Isn't that sad? They're small. How about a 6-inch cubicle for them? That'd take up about 12 boxcars. We could add on more, but that now gives us 216 cars full and 304 still empty. And we got the dinosaurs and all the insects on there. Conclusion, there's plenty of room for Noah, family, and everything they need. Over 300 cars still empty. See, it's not so hard when we follow what the Bible teaches, not what mankind says. Let's stick to God's word. So we know how to answer that one. Yes, lady in the purple.
So what's the picture on the right?
The picture on the right is how many have been to the Ark in Kentucky? Will it float? No. But it won't burn up. It's fireproof. Is that the answer? No, that's the Answers in Genesis Ark encounter there. Wonderful opportunity. It's about 40 miles away from the museum. So if you get a chance to go back, go to the museum. That's a full day to get through that museum. It's power-packed with information and videos. And then the Ark is another at least half a day minimum to go through. That's an AIG advertisement. Oh, let's do another one. Challenge 4. How in the world can the first 3 days of creation be literal days if the sun was not there until day 4? Should we make that side answer this one? Yeah, they'd like that, but we won't do that. You know, every once in a while I feel like being nice, but I try and squish that feeling down. How can the first 3 days be real days? Because God created the earth on day 1 and the sun on day 4. So how can we, as creationists, say the first 3 days can be literal days? Well, let's see what the Bible has to say. And we're going to do a little science. How many like astronomy here? Okay. How about if it said we're going to use fourth grade astronomy to answer this? Does that make it nice? Good, good, good. Okay. What's the definition of a year? What gives us 365 and a quarter days? Where do we get that from? Right. The earth going around the sun. We learned that by the fourth grade. The earth goes around the sun. And that's where we get definition of a year. Where do we get definition of a month? The moon going around the earth. That's an astronomical event. We learned that by the fourth grade. Where do we get a day from? Very good. The rotation of the earth once on its axis. That is the definition of a day. Do we need the sun for that? No, we don't. This one's so bad after all, was it? And here's a quote. Each of the 24-hour periods reckoned from one midnight to the next into which a week, month, or year is divided and corresponding to a rotation of the earth on its axis. That's the definition of a day right there. Right? Your Oxford Dictionary. And all the other ones agree. So we don't need the sun for a literal day. But wait a minute. Let's make this a little tougher. We don't want the easy ones, do we? Genesis 1, 3 through 5. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, so the evening and morning were the first day. What was that light? The sun's not there. We know God is light, but this is a created light. And God was not created. What was that light? Well, there's something interesting that happens here. Ready for a little Hebrew lesson? Yes, you are. Doesn't matter what you say. You're ready. On day 1, Genesis 1:3, God called the light, the Hebrew word is or, O-W-R. And what that word means is illumination. It means there's light, but no reference to a body illuminating, giving that light there. Can God do that? Create light without an object there? Folks, if he can create things out of nothing, he can do that. Did you know Jesus defied gravity? When he ascended into heaven there, at the end of the gospel there, all his apostles are sitting around, disciples sitting around, and he just goes up into the clouds. He defied gravity. Can he do that? Yes, God's the creator of all things. He is not bound by the laws of science, or else the laws of science would be greater than him. And nothing is greater than God. So he can create light. There does not have to be any body of light out there. But when we turn to day 4, when he created the sun, moon, and stars, he used a different Hebrew word called maor, which means luminary, meaning a body giving off the light. So two different Hebrew words used for light here. Does that make sense now, what he's doing? Now, I have a question. If we already had, we're just making this harder and harder, aren't we? If we already had a day and night cycle before the sun, moon, and stars, why did he need to create the sun, moon, and stars? Right. Very good for signs and seasons. So we would have a way of telling time. That is Genesis 1:14 is that answer. Isn't that great? It's right there in the Bible, all this information. So there's the question. And then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. So we would have a way to tell time. Wasn't that nice of him? Wow. See, some of these questions can be really difficult questions until you discover them. And now you're already, all those people that weren't here for Sunday school, you now can ask them these questions. And if they can't give you the answer, you can give them a penalty. Isn't that nice? Conclusion. The first 3 days of creation were literal 24-hour days. We don't need the sun for a day. There are many forms of light, like electromagnetic waves. God created light, and God is light. But this is not the light we're talking about, not the God is light. Okay, challenge five. This is a short one here. You know Adam didn't physically die when he sinned? He didn't die. Matter of fact, he lived for 930 years, didn't he? When he ate from the fruit. So is the Bible just talking about spiritual death, not physical death? I have a doubter over there. There are doubters. What are we going to do to these doubters here? But it says he didn't physically die. That means there could have been physical death all along before sin, couldn't there? See, this is where people who believe in billions of years, they're going to use this. They're going to come in, and you're going to meet these kind of people. They're going to distort God's word, add to God's word, and change it around. Well, let's read this. Genesis 2:16 and 17. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Is that not only just because Adam didn't physically die when he ate of that? So does that mean it's just spiritual death? Well, let's examine a little Hebrew here. You shall surely die. The word die and the word surely just happen to be the same word. The literal translation here is this. Dying, you shall die. In other words, what it's saying there literally is the death process started. Dying, you will die. So it does refer to physical death here also. So we stand a pretty strong case there. The spiritual death happened immediately. The physical death process started at that point. That was a nice short one, wasn't it? Number six. This is the last one here. Then we're going to open it up to questions. I'll let you know, if you don't have questions, I've got lots of questions. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils. What does that sound like? Fire-breathing dragon. Has anybody here seen a real fire-breathing dragon other than Hollywood? I asked that question once. You know, my most scariest audience, I've been in front of NASA scientists and secular universities, they're not the scariest audience. My most scariest audience are the children. I do a lot of first through sixth grade on children. They are scary. Why? Let me give you an illustration. I made that statement. Anybody seen a real fire-breathing dragon? A hand went up in the back of the room. It must have been about a third grade boy. He said, and I said, you seen a real fire-breathing dragon? And he said, yes. I said, where did you see that dragon? Here was his answer. Last night, when my mother was talking to my father. And you've got to change the subject very fast. That's why they're scary. I've been asked questions when I teach them dinosaurs. If a dinosaur stepped on you, which way would you squish? And you need to give a good answer. Because he asked it like a legitimate question. And the real answer is it doesn't matter. You're dead. Okay, so no one's seen a real fire-breathing dragon. So is the Bible not right here? Have we found an error in the Bible?
No.
No, more doubters. Wow. Well, here is a real dragon-like creature that shoots out sparks of fire, called a bombardier beetle. The creature's about a half inch long. And when a predator like a frog approaches this beetle, it shoots out 212 degrees liquid fire. Guess what that'll do to a frog's tongue? Not nice. Now, make sure tonight you check under your pillows. They can be anywhere. Just thought I'd cause a little commotion there. Bombardier beetle. How does it do this? Well, it doesn't have matches, doesn't have a furnace in there. What it's got is two storage tanks. And one storage tank has some chemicals, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide. Do you know what happens when you mix those two chemicals together? Nothing. But in the other storage tank, it's got some inhibitors and some enzymes. Anybody here have enzymes in you? If you don't, you're dead. There's a special kind of protein we call a catalyst that speed things up in our body so we can stay alive. But when it opens the door, shoves those chemicals into the second chamber with the enzymes and inhibitors, it all gets mixed together and shoots out 212 degrees liquid fire. Let me show some pictures of this. What does that look like? Sparks of fire, doesn't it? Show you some more pictures of this creature. It's an incredible creature. They just love to live under pillows. No. How does this creature do this? Can we go way back in time, just a moment, and see how this might have happened? How they developed all this? Well, first of all, the first bombardier beetles wouldn't have had this mechanism. We're going through evolution, if we're going to go at what evolutionists teach. We have these bombardier beetles with no defense mechanism yet. And all the frogs, this is my frog, come along and eat all the beetles. And they're all dead. Maybe one of them survives. And one says, well, gee, I better learn how to defend myself. I'm going to evolve some chemicals. Very smart beetle, because it didn't even take chemistry class and knew how to get the right chemicals. So it gets all the chemicals together and all the enzymes, all the inhibitors, doesn't know how to separate them yet. And if they're all together in there, guess what's happening to all these beetles? They're all exploding up, going poof, 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 and they're all dead. You know what we know about dead things? They don't evolve. Well, maybe one of them survives and says, well, gee, I better learn how to separate these chemicals. And this creature is amazingly smart because it knew how to build this storage tank and never even watched Bob the Builder. Incredibly smart critter here. So now it has the two storage tanks, and it's got the chemicals separated. And here comes that frog again. And that beetle opens that door and shoves the chemicals into the second tank. But it doesn't have the information on how to close that door. Still a teenager. You know how they open up the refrigerator door and look for hours? And what do you say? Close the door, you're letting all the cold air out? If you say that, you've ruined your children. Because that is scientifically false. That is a scientifically false statement saying all the cold air is coming out. Because what's actually happening is heat always moves to cold. You're letting all the hot air in. You're teaching them false scientific information when you say that. You scarred your children now, you know that. Boy, I can really get at people, can't I? Okay, so it doesn't know how to close the door. So now we have all the chemicals mixed together now. Now the explosion's going out both ends. They've just blown their heads off, and they're all dead. You know what we know about dead things? They don't evolve. Well, maybe one of them survives. We got some new information. We know how to close the door now. Here comes that frog again. Beetle opens the door, shoves the chemicals into the second storage tank, closes the door, and shoots out 212 degrees liquid fire. But this creature happens to be an insect. How many legs do insects have? Six. I don't want everybody to be right. Six legs. You know what happens if this beetle doesn't know where its legs are? It just shot its legs off. Now they can't escape, and they're eaten up by the frogs. They can't get away. But you know, this beetle can shoot 360 degrees all the way around and never hit its legs. Where did all this incredible information come from? Certainly not from evolutionary blind chance methods. This doesn't happen that way. All this had to be there from the beginning. We have an amazing creator God, the way he made creatures. So, if a little bitty beetle half inch long, can shoot out sparks of fire. Is it not also possible a creature that lived in the past called Leviathan could also shoot out sparks of fire? If you say no, you're not being scientific, because we know it's possible. We see it today. The Bible is 100% correct, folks. Leviathan was a real creature that could do that. So we've answered, who did Cain marry? We've done the 2 Peter 3:8 challenge. How could Noah fit all the animals in the ark? We found out that wasn't very hard at all, was it? Or we didn't even fill up half the ark and still had room left. The first 3 days could be literal days because we do not need the sun for a day. Adam didn't die immediately because what does it really teach there? The literal interpretation? Dying, you will die. And then Leviathan was a real creature. So we've answered 6 questions there. And I don't want to ask any more because we've got a lot of things twirling around in your brain already trying to remember all those. Remember now, who did Cain marry? Next time I see you anywhere, it could be in a store or someplace, I'm going to ask you that question. So 6 challenges answered. Now, anybody have any questions on creation, evolution, what's happening in the education system? We're going to be talking about some of that. We do have a newsletter out if you'd like to get a newsletter. It's electronic, so it's very easy to get rid of if you don't like to keep it around. So we come up with some of the places we're going to be. We usually have a feature article there and some other good information, what's going on. If you'd like to support us, we do need support. We're running a very major education program now that we think in 5 years' time we'll have equipped 10,000 youth. This is not just listening to a one-hour talk. This is actually equipping them to know how to answer all these kind of challenges. Also, here's some places we're going to be. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we're offering a one-day training class. It'll be at Hoffmantown Church, and these are the times. It's our basic creation training class. We have a sample book out there, what they're going to go through. It's free to attend. It's, if you want a manual, it's $10. But if you want to take it for college credit, it's $45. But everybody can attend. It's open to generally teens and above. And we go through a lot of information that day. It's full day, like a full day of class is what you're going through. But we're divided up into 3 evenings and 1 morning, or 2 evenings and 1 morning. So if you have time, go ahead and attend that. It's got 6 chapters in there. We cover the days of creation in great detail. We cover the counter arguments to the days of creation. We cover some science. Cover a lot of biblical apologetics. And we show how to destroy the entire foundation of evolutionism. So teens especially need to be there. And then we have our elite 5-day class. We have some flyers out there on this. Called our Creation Apologetics Teacher's Course. It's for college age and above. This year is going to be June 15th through the 20th. It's going to be held at Arizona Christian University, just outside Phoenix, Arizona. And we only take 40 students, college age and above. Why? Because we do a lot of workshop in this class. We don't just want you come and listening. This will probably be the most intense class you'll ever be in. I don't say that to frighten you away. This will be our 7th year to hold this class. We only hold it once a year. Why? Because it costs us a lot of money to do this. To break even, we have to raise $32,000 just to break even. Because we give it away at half price. Half price is $590. What does that get you? Get you the 5 days of training, 5 nights in a hotel room. That's $500 right there, folks. And then 3 meals a day for 5 days. For us, the cost is double that for what we have to do there. So we offer it for half price. 40 students, college age and above. We have scientists, PhD scientists attend this every year. We have theologians attend it. College students, we have our 2nd granddaughter coming to this one. Our 1st granddaughter came through it. She is well armed at college. We have medical doctors and just parents come to this. You'll not see a class like this too many other places in the country. You're in class 8:30 till 9 p.m. Yes, long days. And you get a 400-page manual. We cover every page. And you have to do 2 5-minute presentations. I have a stopwatch there. We've had a person go a tenth of a second over. That was a point off. It's really hard for pastors to do this. I love it. Yeah, impossible. We have had a number of pastors come and take this. You do a one-minute defense presentation. There are about six topics. You don't know which one you're going to get. We put you up there, and we challenge you. You've got 3 minutes to give an organized, accurate response. Because we grade you on these things, not only your content knowledge, but on your communication skills. Then you do a written final exam, closed book, closed note. This is our seventh year. Know what our success rate is our first 6 years? Right at 100%. I don't tolerate failure. That's not how we do Christian education. We do have one person whose hair has been to the class. They had very bright black hair before attending, but Geneva changed her life. Yeah, she made it through a couple of times. We do have a lot of returning students come to this because they've never seen anything quite like this. When you're done, you're ready to go to your church and start teaching. That's what our ministry is about, is training others how to do this so the churches can own it and the Christian schools can own it. That's why we don't need to be a big ministry. We want to do what the Bible says. Train others, send them out, and do it that way. It's called discipleship. 2 Timothy 2:2 is our verse. So 40 students. We have a scholarship contest. It ends the end of this month. You need to write an essay. 450 words or less. That's not even a full page. And it has a question you have to answer. And this year we have 4 scholarships. We had 4 donors. 2 are full scholarships, $590. That covers everything except your travel there. And 2 of them are half scholarships. So to attend this 5-day class would cost you $295 for a half scholarship. But $590 is not a lot of money when you look at what you're getting there. All the hotel. It's going to be in Phoenix, Arizona. Don't worry about the heat in June, folks. Don't worry about it. It'll be 100 degrees. But from the hotel to the classroom we'll be in is a 2-minute walk. And the cafeteria is a 3-minute walk. So we were just there. We spent a couple of days there to check everything out. The hotel is a regular hotel on their campus. So don't worry about the heat. You won't be outside anyway. You're inside the whole day speaking, teaching. You're getting taught. And we pick you up from the airport, so you don't have to rent a car. And this will be our seventh year. We're aiming for 100% success already this year. We just don't want to tolerate failure. We want success. Our style of training is modeled after how did Jesus do it. Again, the best model in the world. So if you're interested, you know any college students, you need to be there for this one. Pick up a flyer out there and do that. And now we'll see if you have any questions. Anybody have any specific questions here? Yes, sir.
One thing I'd like you to comment on is I find natural history museums very frustrating because even the really good ones, like we went to the one in New York City, and when you see a skeleton, they won't distinguish between whether it's a bone, a fossil, or a replication of a fossil. And so when you're looking at this stuff, even when you're looking at mastodons or whatever, they won't say, well, this is a real bone. Or why do the museums do that?
Well, why do the museums put, mostly, especially for human fossils, very seldom ever will you see the real fossil. That's because they cost a lot of money, and they keep those hidden away. The replicas you see are a lot of times not that accurate either. Especially the human fossils are not that, because they've been redone to give the appearance of a transitional form. So the students don't really see what was really discovered in many cases with humans. Now, mastodons and dinosaurs, we find it depends on the museum you're in, how much is it going to be real, how much is not. I don't have too much of a problem with some of those. The biggest problem is the human evolution line, which is mostly to give you basically a fraud. In most cases there, what they put for the replicas. But that's the ones I'd have. But it's good to note that to the students going through there, what they're actually seeing. And there's not a lot we can do about that other than teach them the truth. And that's why we're here, is to get some. We'd love to have somebody here, and we already have somebody that can do some teaching, get other people to teach you, have your local creation group, and make sure you do support your local creation group. Because you're very fortunate to have one right here. People can answer your questions. Yes, Geneva.
Regarding the museums, I just wanted to make a comment that a lot of times they separate the old age look at some of the fossils, they're the same, but they have a different name because fossils are named after the scientists that discovered them.
Yes. Yes, like Lucy. How was Lucy got her name? Well, it happened to be a record playing on the radio, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds in Her Hair. The founder, Dr. John Hansen, said, I'll just name this creature Lucy. I have a good friend who discovered a brand new, he's a parasitologist. Anybody want to be one of those? Say parasites. Discovered a brand new parasite. He got to name it. Thought he was doing the right thing. Named it after his wife. Found out that's the wrong thing to do. But I think we're just about out of time here. What time are we supposed to finish this one? We got another 10 minutes. Okay. So yes, we can't change what they're doing in the museums. We can't. Don't even think about changing the public school system, folks. You're not going to do it. What we need to do is get our own house in order. Our own Christian universities got to get them in order, folks. They're killing us. Because you can go to a Christian university and come out of not believing the Bible anymore. So we need to get our own house in order. And if our Christian universities aren't going to do it, then why don't we just do it ourselves? Let's get the churches teaching and get the best way of teaching in the world. It's not fear and intimidation. I just use that because that's just part of who I am. But there are ways to do teaching that are very effective. So great question. Thank you. Yes, sir. Why are they doing 10,000 years ago? Because sometimes it deals with the genealogies in there. They don't trust the genealogies, Genesis 5 and Genesis chapter 5. I've been through there many times. I've been there with other pretty good scholars. And those genealogies are right on the money. You cannot get 10,000 years out of that. But what they're trying to do is add some names in there, saying there's some gaps. And there are no gaps in the way that is written. And that's the primary reason. The other reason might be something called, can I use a big fuzzy college word? Dendrochronology. It's the study of tree rings. And they think some of these trees date up to 10,000 years old. Well, no, they don't, because you can get more than one tree ring a year, depending on the climate. And those are the two main reasons they go to 10,000 years. And I don't buy into that. I always say about 6,000 years. Got to put the word about there. I won't go to 10,000. I don't think the genealogies allow that. It's not a showstopper. No. And if they're going to say 10,000 years, I'm not going to get too upset on that issue. The main thing is evolution's not possible. See, one of the things I teach on evolution is the greatest arguments you can have and are what we call presuppositional arguments. That's another one of those big words. What does pre mean? Supposition means assumptions. Those are the things we assume to be true that we can't prove. In other words, your presuppositions make up your worldview, how you interpret everything. So when I go after the evolutionist, I don't want to spend my time with evidence versus evidence. Why? Because I'm on their turf then. They're setting the rules. What I will do is, why do they interpret it this way? If I can go down to that foundational level, I've destroyed everything they have at that point. And that's the most powerful argument you can actually do. And that is the biblical model of how to do arguments with people. I got an opportunity to do one of those on the airplane down here yesterday for a flight from Boise to Salt Lake City, 40-some minutes. I talked to this one young gal who, cosmic energy out there. And it was fun. I got to give the entire gospel, starting with the creation, Adam and Eve, and all the way up why Jesus went to the cross. And that made sense to her. Then I threw a couple of foundational things of evidence at her, that where did the matter come from? It's your cosmic energy. That's matter. Matter's made up of mass and energy. That's matter. You got to tell me where your cosmic energy came from. She couldn't answer it. And they said, and then she got into this thing. It's just your feelings you have inside of you. I said, that's your feelings. Why should I trust your feelings? Are my feelings wrong? Are you telling me my feelings are wrong? And we got to the point that everybody has their different feelings, and everybody has their different feelings, and they can act on those different feelings. We have anarchy because everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. And she couldn't answer that one. And we got all done. We're getting off the plane. She said, thank you. I've got a lot of things to think about. She said, you never thought about evolution not being true. Because she was living with contradictions. But nobody ever taught her. 20 years ago, I could not have answered those questions. But today, after studying all what the Bible has to teach as a creationist and learning the presuppositions and worldview arguments, you know how to answer these New Agey type questions. And don't worry about if they walk away not being changed, because you're not going to change anybody, are you? All you can do is give the truth. But at the end of the church service, I'll give my testimony, because I grew up a happy heathen and an evolutionist. I was not saved until I was 30. Isn't it great that God has patience with you? If I'd have died before I was 30, I'd have spent eternity in hell. But he had patience with me. What a wonderful God we have. So here's a great tool in teaching. Great tool in teaching. If there's no further questions, we're done. Anybody dare have a question? Yes, sir. How do scientists deal with the soft tissues? Several different ways. One, they ignore it. Don't teach anybody about it. Or we can be like a gentleman who claims to be a Christian and says, oh, soft tissue can last for 100 million years. He makes the claim with no supporting evidence and people believing. So what does that mean? We have to go out and teach the truth, don't we? Because he's persuading our youth not to believe the Bible. And he calls himself a Christian. As a whole ministry, very popular ministry. So that's what they basically do. They come up with excuses or just don't bring it up in the school systems. Okay, now I'll be available for questions during the break time here. And there's plenty of flyers out there. Pick those flyers up. And we'll hope to see some of you in the 5-day class. It is a wonderful class. You'll make friendships that'll last you for life. We have a lot of our students over the last 6 years have been in contact with each other. We've been invited to 2 weddings and 1 pastor appreciation day from people who have been in that class. And somebody just keeps inviting us back. So thank you.